Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for the weekend edition. Section A. Superintendent pick. Ramsey on calendar. Center decisions around students. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. The Midland ISD Board is discussing what calendar makes the most sense for students during the 21-22 school year. But it appears that the board's pick to be the district's next superintendent sees a benefit in making a change to what the district is doing now. Angelica Ramsey, who last week was named the lone finalist to become MISD's academic chief executive, responded to a reporter telegram email that an intersessional calendar gives students needing intervention a fighting chance to get back on track academically. The Midland ISD board discussed calendar options during its regular meeting on Tuesday. It appears the two main options will be a traditional calendar, like the one being used this year, and an intersessional calendar, which provides a week during each semester to use for students needing reading intervention. Ramsey wrote that she has experience with the intersessional calendar, as she taught intersession every year I was in the classroom, and twice while a campus administrator. Ramsey did work at Socorro ISD in the El Paso area, which does use the intersessional calendar. Socorro ISD officials talked with MISD leaders about its experience with the intersessional calendar during a special June 10th meeting. Rick Davis mentioned that parents and MISD staff with questions and concerns about the calendar should watch the segment with Socorro officials to learn more about the calendar. Davis and Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon went through a question and answer during Tuesday's meeting that also covered many basics about the calendar. The advantage of the calendar the board discussed last night is that it provides students the opportunity to receive assistance in a timely manner. TEKS build on one another, many laying a foundation for future standards. Intersession classes allow teachers to work with students who may have struggled with particular standards before the next quarter begins. This gives students a fighting chance to get back on track academically. The MISD board is expected to make its decision on the new calendar during the regular meeting of the board in February, like before Ramsey's first day in Midland, should her contract be approved by the board after a state-mandated 21-day waiting period. Ramsey wrote, she understood these conversations have been ongoing. I would not want my arrival timeline to slow its progress. Dixon told the board moving to an intersessional calendar would help the district in turning around student achievement issues when it comes to reading. Dixon said Tuesday that the percentage of students in Midland ISD elementary schools needing reading intervention at the elementary school level is above 50%. She also mentioned in December that second graders were showing a beginning of the year score of 56, the percentage reading at or beyond grade level. The percentage of eighth graders was 36%. That is just more than one-third reading at or above grade level. Ramsey wrote that the research is clear on the connection between literacy and economic development. This one adjustment can prove to be a high-leverage, purposeful action to improve Midland ISD and the larger community. Change is difficult, but if we continue to center decisions around our students and their best interests, we can be confident we are making the correct choice. Midland ends 2020 with 8% unemployment. Rate drops more than 1 point from November to December. By Mel McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. In a roller coaster year that saw Midland's unemployment rate leap from a low 2.3% in February to a high 12.4% in May, local unemployment ended on a positive note. The Texas Workforce Commission reported Friday that the December unemployment rate in Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, the MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, fell to 8% from 9.3% in November. Still, that is far higher than the 2% recorded for the MSA in December 2019. Odessa likewise saw a sharp drop in its unemployment rate from 11.5% to 13% in November. For the first time in June, Odessa did not report the state's highest unemployment rate. At our board meeting recently, board members said they were seeing an uptick in the market, which is great, Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin, told the Reporter Telegram. He said board members reported some hiring in manufacturing, oil field services, and other industries. Taylor reported that unemployment insurance claims filed in the 17 counties his office oversees have fallen from a high of 6,500 a week last March and April to about 1,000 presently, giving him reason to believe the labor market is stabilizing. What I'm concerned about is the ups and downs of child care. The last year has highlighted the urgent need for access to good, reliable child care, he said, especially since 49% of job seekers in the Permian Basin are female and need child care. People are beginning to see the need for child care out here. We have a younger workforce in the Permian Basin, and they need it, especially since both parents work. Unemployment benefits were recently extended when the omnibus spending bill was signed. I continue to encourage people while they're drawing unemployment to engage in upgrading their skills. They won't get penalized, and it's the ideal time while you're drawing unemployment. When the region's economy returns, we won't return back to a boom. If unemployment remains stable, we'll still have shortages in key areas, education, medical, even oil and gas. That's why it's so important to continue building our infrastructure, homes, roads, and schools. We'll need that to attract people into the community. He added, it's a continuous cycle, continuous training, continuous upgrading. That will be the key to economic recovery. Taylor said an educated workforce created by employers and schools working together and creating pathways for the area's children. Midland's labor force actually declined from November to December by about 350, but that decline was offset by a jump of 1,100 in the number of employed Midlanders, though still down by 11,700. The Midland MSA added 1,100 jobs from November to December. Job growth was led by the area's dominant industrial sector, mining, logging, and construction, which added 500 jobs. Next was trade and transportation and utility sector with 400 new jobs and the government sector with 200 new jobs. Financial activities added 100 new jobs. The only sector to report a loss was the leisure and hospitality sector, down 100. For the 12 months ending December 2020, Midland has lost 12,400 jobs, led by the 9,200 job plunge in the mining, logging, and construction sector. Other services were down 800, while the manufacturing sector was each lost 300 jobs. Financial activities was down 200 jobs. The government sector added 400, and the professional and business sector added 100. Statewide, the unemployment rate fell to 7.2% from 8% in November. Amarillo reported the lowest unemployment at 4.9%. McAllen, Edinburgh, Mission reported the highest unemployment rate at 11.7%. Midland Health opens mass vaccination hub by Caitlin Randall, C-R-A-N-D-L-E at MRT.com. Midland Health opened its COVID-19 mass vaccination hub for a soft rollout on Friday, vaccinating about 240 people. Beginning next week, officials are planning to vaccinate 1,000 people a day. They received 5,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine on Thursday and are expecting to receive the same number of doses weekly for the foreseeable future, Russell Myers said during a press conference. This is one of the best things that's happened to us in a long time. However, they're staying continuously optimistic because there's light at the end of the tunnel, and it's a long tunnel. There are 770,000 people living in Midland County, and at least 18,000 of them are over the age of 65. Individuals who qualify for 1A, Phase 1A, frontline workers, or Phase 1B, 65 and older with chronic health conditions, can sign up for Midland Health's wait list. They'll then receive a text message or email with an appointment time once they're scheduled. Midland Health's infection preventionist, Val Sparks, provided a tour of the vaccination site at the Horseshoe Arena to members of the media on Friday. After receiving a confirmation message with an appointment time, those getting vaccinated will follow signs through the Horseshoe's parking area to the backstage building. From there, they will wait in a line outside until their appointments. Those who fill out their paperwork in advance online will be fast-tracked, while those who need assistance filling out their forms will do so outside. Appointments are spaced about 2 minutes apart to prevent long lines of people waiting. She said the entire process will move quickly and be completed in a few minutes. There will be 8 seats available for vaccinations at one time. After they're given a CDC card with the date of their vaccination, those who've been vaccinated will be asked to wait in their cars for 10 to 15 minutes in case they experience a reaction. Anyone who has a reaction should alert Midland Police or Midland Fire Officers who will be in the parking area. We want people to social distance, Sparks said of the decision to have patients wait in their cars rather than inside the building after being vaccinated. That way they can get in their car, they can start their air conditioner or heater, and they can wait in those cars without a mask on. It's just more comfortable. Sparks said serious reactions to the vaccine are extremely rare. Common mild reactions include a sore arm, fatigue, and chills. If you consider the minor side effects that are possible with this vaccine versus actually having COVID-19 and ending up in the hospital or on a ventilator, then potentially death, this is mild. The small rollout Friday took place from 1 to 4 p.m. The purpose of having a dry run before vaccinations are ramped up next week was to get Midland Health staff familiar with the facility and make sure the process works, Meyer said. Midland Health partnered with the City of Midland, Midland County, and Team Rubicon, a national nonprofit that provides disaster relief, to set up the vacation hub. Those who wish to register for the vaccine waitlist can do so at midlandhealth.org/vaccine. Oil prices retreat to $52 a barrel, by Mel McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Persistent concerns about the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on oil demand undercut oil price strength this week. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange fell 86 cents Friday to close at $52.27 per barrel. The posted price ended the week at $48.75 a barrel. Natural gas on the NYMEX ended in a rough week, falling 4.5 cents to close at 2.446 per MCF on Friday. The commodity's rough week began Tuesday with a 19-cent slide that brought prices to 2.55 per MCF, and prices continued to decline throughout the week. Prices have been a little topsy-turvy, observed Ian Nibor, managing director at Enverus. Speaking with the Reporter Telegram by phone, he said despite the week's decline, prices higher than $50 are encouraging. They're a long way from where we spent a good chunk of last year, especially the second quarter. Everyone has been scarred by the oil market crash of last year. There's nothing like higher prices to make you feel better. Also bringing oil prices lower was the possibility of new supplies coming on the market, especially from Iran. Still, Nibor credited the actions of members of the OPEC countries and allied producing nations with offering support to oil prices. The aggressive efforts of Saudi Arabia in unilaterally enacting production cuts to support prices was a bit of a surprise, praising their intention to support prices while oil supply and demand regain balance. Overall, he said, oil is in a better spot today than he expected. We didn't quite expect the level of improvement we have now. Nibor acknowledged that there is some concern that the higher prices, which are within or slightly above break-even range for most Permian Basin producers, could incentivize them to increase production. If prices are sustained and even improve, there is concern on additional supplies. Everyone will be watching operator discipline. An additional concern is that the higher prices could allow operators to operate within cash flow and not have to go to Wall Street for capital. That would allow them to bypass investors who could serve to keep supplies in check. Niebuhr said the market is sensitive to any shift in developments related to the pandemic and its impact oil demand. Even so, he senses a lot of cautious optimism in the energy industry and said there is reason to be upbeat. Prices have some space to get higher this year as the vaccine rolls out and economies open up. U.S. rig count continues to recover. Drilling activity continued to move higher this month, recovering from last year's activity collapse. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes and data analytic firm Enverus reported Friday in their weekly rig count that the national tally rose 5 to 373, well above the record of 244 seen last August. The count is 416 rigs below the 794 reported at work last year. There are 289 rigs drilling for oil, up 2, but 387 below the 676 seeking oil a year ago. There were 88 rigs drilling for natural gas, up 3. Texas added 6 rigs to 175. Alaska, North Dakota, Ohio, and West Virginia joined Texas in adding to their counts. New Mexico lost 5 rigs. The Permian Basin dropped 1 rig to 188. Lee County, New Mexico, was the most active county in the Permian with 35 rigs, unchanged for the week. Midland County, Martin County, and Loving County each reported 19 rigs this week. Howard County reported 17, and Reeves County had 13 rigs at work. Winkler County showed no activity this week. According to Enverus, the U.S. rig count is up 6% in the last month, but down 48% year over year. The company also said that week over week, the Permian Basin added the most rigs, adding 12 active rigs over last month. Midland County to resume jury trials, from staff reports. Criminal and civil jury trials will resume in Midland County in March, according to a press release from the Midland County Judiciary. Jury trials were canceled at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, then briefly resumed in August before being halted again in November because of rising cases. To address the need to protect citizens and at the same time resume jury trials, the courts of Midland County have implemented a series of protective measures for jury proceedings. These protective measures include using the Horseshoe Arena for jury selection and using reconfigured courtrooms at the Midland County Courthouse for actual trials. Additionally, the number of individuals allowed in the courtroom during a trial will be limited, and face masks or face shields will be required. Emergency medical personnel will conduct COVID-19 screenings as jurors check in at the Horseshoe and as jurors report to their courtrooms. Staff will also be routinely disinfecting chairs, exhibits, and microphones. 4 jury trials have already occurred in 2020 using the COVID-19 safety plan at the Horseshoe Arena and at the Midland County Courthouse, with no issues reported and with very possible positive feedback from the participants. Midland ranks number 1 in country in young resident homeownerships from 2009 to 2019, by Stuart Doreen, Storeen, at HearstMP.com. Midland topped the rankings for cities across the country where young residents are buying homes from 2009 to 2019, according to SmartAsset.com. The financial advisory website reported Midland had a 10-year increase of 17% in the homeownership rate among people younger than 35, the largest growth seen in this study. The total homeownership for that age cohort in 2019 was 52%, the fourth highest rate we analyzed for that metric. Together, this makes Midland the top place where more young residents are buying homes. Also, SmartAsset reported no city in the top 50 had a larger percentage point change than Midland. Also, Midland was just one of 2 cities in SmartAsset's top 50 to have a change of more than 10 percentage points. Midland was one of 2 Texas cities in the top 10. Mesquite was number 4. The study also showed that under 35 ownership rate decreased by 3.7% on average across the 200 cities analyzed. The study also showed home ownership rate in the country peaked at a little more than 69% in 2004 before falling to 63% in 2016. To find out more about the study, including methodology, go to the website online, smartasset.com/mortgage/where-more-young-residents-are-buying-homes 2021. Questions and answers about the school calendars. The main options for Midland ISD's 2021-22 school calendars appear to be between a traditional calendar, which is similar to the calendar being used this year, and an intersessional calendar, which includes an additional week break in both the fall and spring to be used for reading intervention for students that need it. Starting dates: traditional calendar, August 16th. Intersessional calendar, August 9th. Ending dates: traditional calendar, May 26th. Intersessional calendar, June 3rd. Days of instruction: both calendars offer 180 days or 77,500 minutes. Intersessional weeks: October 18th to the 22nd and March 14th to 18th, the week after spring break. Note: otherwise, the days off are the same, including Thanksgiving, Christmas, and spring breaks. What would the intersessional week look like for those that attend school? 5 hours of instruction a day for 5 days. That is 1,500 minutes of instruction. The classes are supposed to be smaller and provide more individualized instruction for intense reading. Would teachers be forced to work intersessional weeks? No. Those working would receive premium pay. During Tuesday's meeting, Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon described that as $300 a day or $1,500 a week. Who's eligible for intervention during intersessional weeks? Students in kindergarten through sixth grade. MAISD would receive state funding for students that participate in kindergarten through fifth, and the district would foot the bill for sixth. Those are the grades where students have struggled the most on state assessments. Would it be mandatory? No, but Midland ISD leaders are talking about requiring students to pass state assessments to advance to the next grade. Should that take place, then some believe that would provide an incentive for parents to send their students if they require intervention. What about the other grades? It was mentioned that academic camps or other enrichment opportunities for students in grades 7 through 12 could be held, but there are no particulars at this time. Couldn't this learning take place after school? Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon says no. She said it has never worked in secondary grades because too many students participate in after-school activities. It would also create transportation issues for students. She said it creates longer days for students and teachers, and the experience would not be beneficial. Board member Katie Joyner believes that extending the typical day by 15 minutes would allow for more classroom time to provide a similar benefit. What's something else about the calendars? Dixon said there is a state-required planning time in both calendars, 45 minutes for elementary teachers, 55 minutes for secondary teachers in the traditional calendar. She said that a shorter day in the intersessional calendar actually allows for more planning time above the state requirement. Why just interventions for reading? What about math? Dixon said there is a need for math and interventions, but this would be a new program, and there is no need to bite off more than the district officials can chew. A successful first year would give officials a reason to expand it. How far behind are students in reading? Midland ISD officials said that in grades 6 and below, more than 50% of students require some type of intervention. In at least one school, that percentage is higher than 70. What calendar do principals prefer? Dixon said all principals were provided an opportunity to participate in a survey, and 69% preferred the intersessional calendar. Of those members of the DEIC that participated in the survey, 67% stated the intersessional calendar would be best for the students. What about special needs students? Could they attend the schools during those intersessional weeks? Yes. Will teachers be required to teach during those two intersessional weeks? No. Their contract is for 187 days, 180 for instruction, 2 teacher work days, and 5 days of staff development. Those that choose to work intersessional weeks would receive extra pay. How would teachers be picked? There would be an interview process, and those with a track record of success in reading instruction would be given priority. How were those weeks selected? Each starts 11 weeks after the start of a semester. What will likely factor into the board deciding to approve the intersessional calendar? Academic opportunities for students who don't need intervention but could use enrichment during those weeks. The academic performance issues, according to some board members, extend beyond the elementary school level. An intersessional calendar is approved that finishes the school year before Memorial Day. Having extra days prior earlier in the year seemed preferable to coming back to campus after the unofficial start of summer. Teachers are vocal about their support for the calendar, and supporters can show them the benefits of the calendar, including the shorter school day. What will likely factor into the board deciding to approve the traditional calendar? In June, when the previous board voted down a different intersessional calendar, board members saw polling that showed parents supported the traditional calendar. That vote took place less than 2 months prior to when school would have been started. There is a belief that intervention could still happen within a normal day and inside a traditional calendar. It is what people know. Children and teachers need the longest summer break possible and don't need the burden of untraditional weeks off during the school year. Obituaries and death notices. At 102, Alma Vivian Cook Connor passed from this earth to her heavenly home on January 18th. A private family graveside service will be held at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Walsh Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Anne Leslie Hendricks Wood, 58, passed away on Monday, January 18th in Midland, surrounded by her loving family. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, January 23rd at 3 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the First Presbyterian Church or High Sky Children's Ranch. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Walsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Cecilia Bonilla Lozano, 66, of Midland, left this earth on January 18th. Due to COVID-19, private services will be held. Funeral services under the direction of Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Deanie Humphrey, 79, of Midland, passed away Tuesday, January 19th. No services will be held. Donations to the American Heart Association or charity of your choice. Deborah Susan Williams passed away last week. Funeral services will be held Wednesday, January 27th at 10 a.m. at First Christian Church, followed by burial at Rest Haven Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to Safe Place and Butner Homes. Evelyn Stapp Thornton passed away on January 15th. Public visitation will be held Wednesday, January 27th, 6 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. Graveside services will be Thursday, January 28th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Glenda Sue Power passed away on January 18th in Midland. The funeral service will be held Monday, January 25th at 11:30 a.m. at Nellie Picklin Walsh Funeral Home in Midland, followed by burial at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Memorials may be sent to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Walsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Jack Lee Palick, 84, of Midland, passed away on January 11th. Donations may be made to the Kids College Program at Midland College. Private family services will be held at a later date. Lisa Ann Zeisel Crawford, 54, of Midland, passed away on January 6th. Public visitation will be Monday, January 25th, 2 to 6 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. Funeral services will be Tuesday, January 26th at 1 p.m. Please visit ellisfuneralhomes.com to leave online condolences. Mary Jane Sapp Williams passed away last week. Memorials may be given to the Holy Trinity Episcopal Church in Midland. or Trinity School. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Peggy Nell Henry Wortham, age 93, passed away on Sunday, January 3rd. A private family service will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Robert Owen Carroll of Midland passed away on January 21st. His family will hold a private service. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Sui Ping Yi, 94, of Oakland, California, passed away on Monday, January 11th. A visitation will be at 7 p.m. on Friday, January 29th at Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 30th at the chapel. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Charles Bubba Butler passed away last week. Services will be held in Germany. David Evans, 43, passed away on Wednesday, January 20th. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, January 26th at Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Private family graveside services will be held. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Victor R. Gonzalez, 61, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, January 21st. A private family service will be held. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, January 23rd, 2021. Section A. Cervantes out as OHS football coach. Led program for five seasons by Tony Venegas. Ector County ISD Executive Director of Athletics Bruce McCrary said Friday that Odessa High head football coach Danny Cervantes has been reassigned from his duties as leader of the Broncos football program. Cervantes went 0-7 with the Broncos in a truncated 2020 season and finished with a 10-37 mark over his five seasons leading Odessa High. The Broncos had three games canceled this season due to schedule changes made via COVID-19 precautions. His best season was a 5-5 mark in 2018, and Odessa High did not make the playoffs in any of his five seasons. District leadership evaluates all programs, and through the evaluation process, that was determined, McCrary said. Moving forward, we will start the search immediately. We'll work with the Odessa High community, from parents, players, and alumni, to build a profile of what the next head football coach will be. Calls to Cervantes for a comment on the change were not returned. McCrary also confirmed that assistant head coach and offensive coordinator Dean Garza would take over the position on an interim basis until a new hire is made. He declined to comment on where Cervantes would be reassigned to. Odessa High is the third school from District 2-6A that will have a new head coach heading into the 2021 season. Midland High is looking for a new head coach to replace Tim Anaschivitz, who was reassigned in December, while San Angelo Central has started its search after Brent Davis was hired Thursday at Gregory Portland High School in South Texas. Cervantes coached Odessa High after spending 9 years as the head coach at Lubbock Estacado, compiling a 54-50 record and guiding the Matadors to the playoffs each season. Lubbock Estacado had been 2-28 in the three previous seasons before Cervantes' hire in 2007. He graduated from Permian in 1986 and was a member of the 1984 state championship team. He also was an assistant coach on the Permian football staff from 1996 to 2000 and was the boys' basketball coach for the Panthers from 2000 to 2005. Having as many ties to the community is what McCrary said made making this decision difficult. Danny Cervantes is a great man. He's a good guy, and he means a lot to us, McCrary said. That's why we wanted to make sure that we were doing our due diligence and making the right decisions, because he is an important person in the community. We have a lot of respect for Danny Cervantes. McCrary added that the district had received plenty of feedback in recent weeks about the direction of the program. The Broncos are now left looking for a new leader who will try and get them back to the postseason for the first time since 2013. "That's always important to us," McCrary said. "When you make decisions like that, you have to make sure that you're doing the right thing. You can't make a rash decision." "We met with and heard from several members of the community, and all that stuff is valuable when you're evaluating programs. That doesn't make your final decision, but it certainly helps." McCrary said that he would not be leading the search committee for a new head coach, rather a committee within ECISD. He confirmed that he's retiring from his position effective June 30 after serving in that role over the past 3 years. McCrary did not give a specific date as to when he hoped the position would be filled, only that the search committee would be looking for the best candidate. Mass vaccination practice run successful. Ratliff Stadium effort begins Sunday, by Federico Martinez. About 200 Odessa healthcare officials, law enforcement, and community volunteers cheered Friday's successful practice run of a mass COVID-19 vaccination process, which will kick off at 9 a.m. Sunday at Ratliff Stadium. The practice run did expose a few minor glitches, mostly internet and traffic route related, but were quickly straightened out. Trevor Tankersley, Medical Center Health Systems Director of Public Relations, said, "That's exactly why we do dry runs, so that we can identify any problems in advance," Tankersley said. "Most of the problems have already been corrected, and we're ready for Sunday." Pfizer COVID-19 vaccination shots will be given from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday, Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tippin said. After that, vaccinations will be available from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Mondays through Fridays. Health officials are asking people who are healthy to wait a couple days before seeking a vaccination. The goal is to first offer shots to frontline healthcare workers and people most at risk, including the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions like diabetes. But no one will be turned away if they show up for a shot, Tippin said. MCH received their first weekly shipment of 3,900 doses of the Pfizer vaccine Thursday and will continue to receive shipments until everyone in the Odessa area have had an opportunity to be vaccinated, Tippin said. Those who receive the Pfizer vaccine will be scheduled to return in about a month to receive a second shot, which is needed to acquire immunity to the coronavirus. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Abbott-Timmons said beginning Sunday, the goal is to vaccinate 1,000 to 1,200 people per day. But those numbers are not set in stone. The process will go faster if people first pre-register their information online at http://secure.echd.org/QDREGVAX/default.aspx. The pre-registration link is not for setting up an appointment or a specific date and time to receive the vaccination, Timmons said. It's a pre-registration tool that will speed up the process of administering the vaccine. People who don't pre-register prior to arriving at the stadium will be rerouted to a waiting area where they will have to register before they can proceed to the vaccination area, Abbott-Timmons said. Everyone seeking a vaccine should bring a valid driver's license or other photo identification so that workers can quickly determine if someone has already pre-registered. Officials are also asking those who are seeking a vaccination to wear a short sleeve shirt or clothes that are easy to access the upper arm. City Manager Michael Marrero said the mass vaccination effort is a collaboration between many entities, including MCH and ORMC staff, community volunteers, city police, firefighters, and EMTs who will be administering most of the vaccines. Kudos to everyone involved, from a very supportive city council that provided funding for COVID testing, funds to help purchase laptops for students, and for creating a small businesses assistance program, Marrero said. I think every city department has been involved in some way, including EMTs, law enforcement, and the Parks Department. I couldn't be prouder of our staff. Community volunteers are still needed for a variety of tasks, including helping with traffic control, providing water and food to healthcare staff. For more information on volunteering, send an email to volunteers@odessa-tx.gov. COVID-19 vaccines. Editor's note, do not show up at Ratliff Stadium today. Saturday. The vaccines do not begin until Sunday. Medical Center Hospital will be administering Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine through the drive-through clinic at Ratliff Stadium, South Main Entrance. Odessa Regional Medical Center, ORMC, is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. The vaccine is free of charge while supplies last. Please check on vaccine availability. For more information, call 432-582-8549 or visit tinyurl.com/Y3JQHZ89. Walgreens is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. For more updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y3LNWU83. HEB has requested more COVID-19 vaccine from the state of Texas. Once they have vaccine, eligible customers can sign up using the scheduler to receive a COVID-19 vaccine at no cost. To sign up, get updates or information, visit vaccine.heb.com. The CVS stores will soon have the no-cost COVID-19 vaccine available. They will administer in a phased approach based on state guidelines when available to pharmacies. For updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y508QJE4. Local news roundup. Virtual fundraiser. The Power of One virtual luncheon and children's style show benefiting CASA of West Texas has been scheduled for 11:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. February 25th. Sponsorships are available or consider donating a silent auction item. CASA also has an Amazon wish list at tinyurl.com/Y5JPHM48. For information, call 432-683-1114, extension 19, or email Katie Sheehan at kseahan@casawtx.org or visit www.casawtx.org. Adoption event. The Odessa Animal Control, 910 West 42nd, has scheduled an adoption event for January to help find every shelter pet a forever home. All fees are waived and pets are fully vetted. For more information, call 368-3527. Visit tinyurl.com/YXK3YUC2. Man pleads guilty to improper relationship between teacher and student. A 32-year-old man who worked as a teacher's aide for Odessa High School in 2018 pleaded guilty Wednesday to improper relationship between educator and student. Sammy Martinez was sentenced to 7 years probation and deferred adjudication. Ector County 161st Judicial District Judge Justin Lowe approved the deal, while Michael McLeish was the attorney. Martinez was arrested August 8, 2018, and was taken into custody at 11:30 a.m. by Ector County Independent School District Police. Odessa Police Department reportedly received a sexual assault report July 5, 2018. It was reported that several inappropriate messages had been sent between Martinez and a 16-year-old male with special needs. The investigation also discovered there had been a sexual relationship between both subjects, a previous Odessa American article detailed. Obituaries for Saturday, January 23rd. Nelva Martin Foster. Nelva Martin Foster, 93, passed away January 18th in Odessa. Funeral services are pending. Nelva was born May 16th, 1927, in Brownwood to Ottie and Silas Martin. She married A.B. Foster Jr. in 1948 in Sweetwater. She was preceded in death by her husband of 66 years, A.B. Foster. She is survived by her daughters, Rebecca Yao and husband Field, Melanie Burkholder and husband Duncan, 7 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren. Memorials may be made to Hardin-Simmons University and West of the Pecos Museum, or to a charity of your choice. Delora Jean Thompson Stallnacker. Lubbock. Delora Stallnacker, 83, passed away Thursday, January 21st. She was born November 12, 1937, to Cecil R. and Willie L. Thompson in Lubbock. She married Dr. Eugene Stallnacker in Lovington, New Mexico, and they resided in Lubbock. She is survived by her husband, Dr. Eugene Stallnacker, daughter Lynn and husband Craig Van Amberg, son Jerry Allen McLemore, and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Delora is preceded in death by her grandmother, Delora Thompson, and several aunts and uncles. At her request, there will be no services. You are encouraged to share memories and expressions of sympathy at www.memorialdesigners.net. Memorials are suggested to South Plains Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Lubbock or Saving Grace Pitbull Rescue in Lubbock. Maria Lara Cadena. Maria Celia Lara Cadena, 90, beloved mother, grandmother, and sister, passed away January 14th in Odessa. Visitation will be Sunday, January 24th from 1 to 9 p.m., with rosary being held at 7 p.m. at Martinez Funeral Home. Funeral service will be Monday, January 25th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church at 1 p.m., with burial to follow at Peaceful Gardens, Ector County Cemetery. Maria was born in Alpine to Jose U. Lara and Gertrudis Tula O. Lara, May 24th, 1930. She married Joe N. Cadena, Sr. in 1947 in Alpine. Maria is predeceased in death by her parents, Jose U. Lara and Gertrudis O. Lara, grandmother Rosario Galindo, a grandson, her brothers Joe Lara Jr., Chito, Willie Lara, Efren Lara, Alfredo Lara, and her sisters Guadalupe Gonzalez and Annabelle Navarro. Maria is survived by her children, daughters Gracie Cadena and partner Monica Rodriguez, Diana Chavez and husband Raymond of Odessa, Annabelle Sanchez of Midland, Olga Quiroz of Arlington, her son, John Joe Cadena Jr., and partner Mary Marlowe of Trinidad, sisters Anita Galindo and Gloria Navarrete of Odessa, brother Daniel O. Lara of New Mexico, 10 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and 6 great-great-grandchildren. Visitation will take place at Martinez Funeral Home Sunday, January 24th from 1 to 9 p.m. with rosary being recited at 7 p.m. Funeral services will take place Monday, January 25th at 1 p.m. at St. Elizabeth Catholic Church. Burial will take place at Ector County Cemetery, Peaceful Gardens section. William B. Bill Perrell. William B. Perrell, 86, of Kerrville, passed away Monday, January 18th. His service was held Friday, January 22nd in the family cemetery with Reverend Matt Melton officiating. Bill was born in Kerrville, March 19, 1934, to Winnie and Charles B. Peril. He married Pat Johnson in 1957. Bill taught math for 30 years in Odessa, and they moved back to Kerrville in 2003. Bill was preceded in death by his parents, Winnie and Charles B. Peril. He is survived by his wife, Pat, daughter Cindy Peril Schultz of San Antonio, and sister Marianne Peril Hart and husband Spencer of Kerrville. Arrangements are under the direction and personal care of the professionals at Kerrville Funeral Home. Death notices. Sui Ping Yi, Round Rock. Sui Ping Yi, 94, of Oakland, California, died Monday, January 11th in Round Rock. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. January 30th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Visitation will be held from 7 to 8 p.m. Friday, January 29th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Teresa Fanapin. Teresa Fanapin, 61, of Odessa, died Thursday, January 14th. A celebration of life will be held at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, January 24th at Acres West 24-Hour Chapel. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, January 25th at Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Michael Arthur Hansen. Michael Arthur Hansen, 61, of Odessa, died Wednesday, January 20th. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Erica Ann Valdez James. Erica Ann James, 39, of Odessa, died Friday, January 15th. A memorial service was held Saturday, January 23rd at University Park Fellowship. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, January 24th, 2021. Section A. Murray says ECISD not going back to normal, by Ruth Campbell. As Ector County ISD moves through the COVID-19 pandemic and all its attendant uncertainty, Superintendent Scott Murray knows one thing for sure. Things will not go back to business as usual when it's over. Even before the pandemic, ECISD was working on its strategic plan, but it found that items in the plan had to be acted on immediately due to circumstances. Recently, Murray published an article in EdSurge titled, "The Pandemic Closed Our Doors But Opened Our Minds: Why My School District Will Not Return to Normal." A year ago, ECISD looked at its data and realized it was not where it wanted to be, and that the way the district was designed was not working for every student. In fact, it wasn't working for most of our kids. That's not a place we want to go back to. We want to go to a new place, a better place. We've learned a lot through the pandemic, Murray said. There are things that we don't want to continue, like I am wearing a mask right now. I would hope that that is not part of my permanent future. So that's something that we would clearly like to change. But other things that we've learned are pretty remarkable. For example, Murray visited Wilson and Young Medal of Honor Middle School Thursday. They're in the process of finishing up an assessment called the Measure of Academic Progress. One of the things that they noticed in their academic areas is their virtual students performed better in the area of reading and English than their face-to-face students. Their face-to-face students performed better in the area of math than their virtual students. At this point in time, most of the children who are virtual are experiencing success at virtual, whereas at the beginning of the year, we had almost 85% of our kids virtual. Some kids were really struggling. Many of the kids who are still in a virtual environment are experiencing success, Murray said. He added that he found that data point from Wilson and Young fascinating. Murray said officials at Wilson and Young are trying to figure out why the virtual students are doing better in English than the in-person ones. Is that a better way for kids to learn? Or are there specific strategies that those teachers are using with those kids in a virtual environment that are better than the strategies that are being used face-to-face? The data was surprising to them. They didn't anticipate that, so they're going to dig into that to better understand it. That data should create positive change for those kids, potentially. If there are strategies that they are using virtually, how could we replicate those same strategies in face-to-face environment? How can we leverage the tools of technology effectively much more so than we're doing today? Murray said he has had numerous parents ask him if ECISD will continue offering virtual learning for their students because some have blossomed as students in that environment. Because of the pandemic, Murray added, teachers have learned improved use of technology. Our kids are leveraging technology to a much higher level. In some cases, that's good for them, learning new tools, learning new ways of communicating, learning new strategies and techniques that are proving to be effective. Those are the things that we need to continue, Murray said. He noted that one of the comments he has received from teachers is they have realized once again how important the relationship between the teacher, student, and parent is. The pandemic has required much more communication between the school and family. Our teachers have learned a lot about the family lives of some of our kids. They've engaged in many more conversations with moms and dads about how to support kids at home. So that is something that we want to continue. The relationships that have been developed between teacher and student and family are critical. They are essential to kids moving forward, Murray said. Research shows that when children have healthy relationships with adults on campus, whether it's a teacher, cafeteria worker, or custodian, their achievement increases, he said. Tied into that, Panorama Education conducted a school connectedness survey this fall. School connectedness, defined as the belief adults and peers care about their learning and about them as individuals. This fall, 59% of students in grades 3 through 12 said they feel connected, 61% in the national average in a pre-COVID atmosphere. Our goal is to be at the national average next spring and at 63% by 2024, January 19th school board recap said. The survey covered the sense of belonging, school climate, rigorous expectations, school engagement, and supportive relationships. Overall, the highest rated area was supportive relationships, with 72% positive responses. The lowest area was school engagement at 45% positive responses. Another survey will be conducted in the spring. Murray said students also were surveyed on engagement. Students said they were sitting too much and that they needed to be more active. He did note that some students have developed better relationships with their teachers virtually than they had in person. The pandemic has also exposed the haves and have-nots in ECISD. One example is internet access at home. He noted that there are some families who don't want internet in their homes. We had talked about that as a district. A part of our strategic plan was to ensure that over the next 4 years, every family has broadband in their home, but we've had to significantly accelerate that work. There are kids even still today, January of 2021, and we have some of our students who are at home without internet access because it is simply not available to them. And they're learning through pencil paper packets still today. I know that the learning of those children has been significantly impacted because of this, and that's just not right. We as a community, as a state, as a nation, have the ability to provide high-speed broadband to every family. Broadband should be a utility just like electricity and water, the other basic utilities that families fundamentally have in their homes, Murray said. The district is working with SpaceX on a pilot project to provide broadband to families in the Pleasant Farms area, but that is not ready to go yet. Food is another matter. Part of the district's strategic plan was to ensure that all students over the next couple of years, regardless of income status, would have access to a free breakfast and lunch. But we accelerated that, and so today, all of our students have access to free breakfast and lunch, Murray said. Meals are provided at school for pickup and delivery. We actually have hundreds of meals delivered every day, Murray said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.